and welcome to the AFA podcast, the official podcast of animationforadults.com. This episode is a Cardiff Animation Festival interview special to celebrate the Cardiff Animation Festival, which runs from April the 23rd to 26th, 2026. By the magic of Zoom, I sat virtually down with five of the most talented animators in the UK who have all got films in the Cardiff Animation Festival this year. First up is Nathan Adai, whose film Mental Roots is screening at this year's festival. Hello, Nathan Adai. Welcome to the AFA podcast.
Yes, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
And we always like to get started at the very beginning, and that is with the question, how did you get started in animation?
Okay. Ever since a young kid, really, animation has been an interest. I think it was around secondary school when I started considering it as a possible career route. For me, I've always loved drawing, especially in primary school. I remember when, this was probably around the time Cars had come out, Disney Pixar's Cars. And I had a fascination with that film. I started designing my own characters in the style of Cars as well. I think that was probably one of the earliest seeds where I realized, okay, I really do have, I guess, a chance of doing something in the animation industry, because I had that imagination of, you know, if I was designing my own characters for existing films or designing my own idea for a film for a studio like Pixar, what concept would I come up with? Back when DVDs were more of a thing, I used to design DVD covers of made up animated films. So even back then, even thinking about like marketing, you know, looking back, it was pretty advanced stuff for a primary school kid to be thinking about. I guess we've kind of come full circle now as I'm in my late 20s. I've got an award-winning short film, which we'll talk about. I've been able to go to different animation festivals and have my work recognized there. And now I've got my own business that I've started, which has been inspired by the Mental Roots short film, which looks more at the film's subject matter, which is mental health, particularly in culturally diverse contexts. And basically, I'm taking that animation into different workshops where I'm teaching young people about the basics of mental health and how you can use animation and visual creativity as a tool to address these sort of social issues. So it's pretty much a full circle moment. And now I'm teaching part-time in animation at the university, at Nottingham Trent University. That's pretty much my animation journey, summed up. And, it's always been about escapism for me. That's what I've loved about animation. But also using it as a medium to communicate deeper topics as well in a way that live action can't capture.
So what's the story behind Mental Roots specifically, the animation?
Yeah, so in short, it's a short film that looks at, it's from a first person perspective. So I'm narrating the short film from the perspective of this character. And it's a young black male who is going through various pressures, various kind of struggles internally. And suddenly he wakes up one morning with, feeling a lot lower than usual. And he's trying to look at the roots as to what has gotten to this place of pessimism and despair, and kind of looking at, well, you know, how in a world, I guess, in a context where a lot of people are living as shells of themselves, just going through the motions, trying to get by. He learns that to truly be free and to kind of shake off these inner demons, there is power in vulnerability. And so that's the message of the short film, without trying to give away too much. But there's a lot of visual metaphors in there. It's spoken word narrated by myself. I had a kind of mentor/co-writer develop the narration with me as well. And the whole short film was commissioned by a scheme called New Creatives, which was a joint venture between BBC and a production company called Rural Media. So similar to Random Acts by Channel 4, where young filmmakers pitch an idea for a short film, and if they think it has potential, it gets funding and gets aired on BBC 4, as well as the BBC New Creatives website. So that's kind of a summary of Mental Roots and the how it came to be.
What was it that inspired you to create a film about the issue of mental health in the black community?
Yeah, so specifically with the black community, long story short, originally it was actually a concept idea I had for my coursework, because as when I started, when I got selected for the commission to do it, it was during my third year of my animation degree. So originally it was just a coursework idea before I submitted it to Rural Media. And the reason why I came up with this theme was I was starting to just research different issues that have started to affect the black community, particularly within Britain. And when I did a bit of research, I stumbled across some stats on mental health. So at the time, this was around early 2020 when I was looking into this stuff. And at the time, there was a stat, I believe, from the charity Mind UK, where it said black people in the UK are around seven times more likely to be sectioned under the Mental Health Act. And particularly with black men, they seem to be like the most vulnerable group to more severe sort of conditions like psychosis as well. And culturally, I could kind of understand why that might be the case, because especially within African and Caribbean communities, it's very common that you hear, messages of resilience. Being a first generation or a second generation black Brit in your family, there can often be that pressure to not complain. And despite the different levels of discrimination or marginalization that you might feel in a society where you are considered to be the minority. So it's kind of looking at how culturally we've learned how to suppress some of the trauma and things that we've experienced. And then also looking at, the lack of representation in mental health support, or more specifically, mental health support that is culturally informed. So that, when black people open up about their experiences, they can feel that they are understood without their weaknesses being used against them or without being misunderstood. And so this animation helps to address the stigma, encourage more, especially young black men, to not give in to negative stereotypes of black masculinity, but to be the change that they want to see by opening up about their weaknesses, getting the support they need, so that they get help to overcome trauma, emotional issues, and then we continue to improve the next generations in our families as well, with better emotional well-being and just a healthier kind of masculinity, if that makes sense. So it's a very loaded topic, but I've shown it in various contexts, and it's impacted not just young black men, to talk about, being the change that we want to see, but also various other people from various backgrounds have similarly been impacted by the short film as well.
Awesome. How was the film's visual style developed?
It was very much kind of following on from the style I've developed at uni. So very much kind of using Photoshop as my main sort of software, very kind of hand-drawn. I like using the pastel sort of brushes in Photoshop. So that's kind of what I was familiar with at the time, and I just stuck with that. And it seems to have really helped the style of the animation, because it's quite a down-to-earth sort of gritty kind of theme and world that I'm painting. So the organic sort of pastel-like texture really complements that nature of the film.
You mentioned before it's the story told from a first person perspective. Why did you decide to do that?
Just to really put the viewer in the shoes of this character and help build empathy with a kind of person that historically has not had a lot of empathy in their representations. And by that, I mean black men specifically. I really have a passion, obviously, being a black man myself, British Ghanaian. I definitely have a passion to help improve specifically black British representation in animation. I think in live action, we've seen a lot of progress in that area in the past few years, but I want to see that translated to animation. So, again, using the power of animation, I knew that I didn't have to restrict myself to the rules of live action. For example, filming something from the first person perspective in live action can be technically quite demanding, but it can be more easily done with animation. And again, that first person perspective really puts you in the shoes of this main character so that you feel that you're going through what they're going through. And I think that technique has really helped build a lot of empathy for many young black men who might be experiencing what the main character experiences in that short film.
How did you land on the motif of the masks?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was as I was doing the visual development, it just made sense, this idea of masking, this idea of more specifically looking at black male identity, this kind of performativity that we might feel peer pressured to give into, this kind of pressure either coming from peers and or representations of black men in the media. They can feel this need to be tough or be the funny guy, kind of have on this hard exterior so that no one can see your weakness and so that your weakness can't be used against you. So that's kind of what the different expressions on the masks kind of represent, even especially in the middle scene where you see the main character with his homeboys on the council estate. You can see all the different masks that they're putting on, the different expressions, whether it's masking their real emotions with their eyes on the money or trying to look like a star or hiding their pain with their talents. And so I wanted to hint at all these different masks that might be popularized in our culture, that could mask the real pain and trauma that's under the surface.
What were the particular challenges that you faced making the film?
We made it during COVID, so that's the big
All
challenge
right.
there. But I guess the great thing about animation in today's age is it could all be done remotely, so we use that to our advantage. We worked completely remotely as a team. So yeah, for me, it was just navigating COVID generally. But I guess on the flip side of that, it gave me, because obviously, the theme itself was very much relevant to what was happening during the time anyway. You had COVID, so that was really, I guess, causing more of an awakening on the topic of mental health. And then on top of that, in the summer of 2020, the killing of George Floyd, the unjust killing of George Floyd, obviously kind of reignited awareness of institutional racism. And so you've got these two kind of topics overlapping, and obviously mental roots is very much kind of an intersection of those topics. So it worked out in that sense. It felt quite therapeutic to make the film during that time. But yeah, juggling a lot. I was finishing my full-time BA degree, going straight into my master's in visual communication, and just other personal things going on in my life. So yeah, it's like sometimes it did feel quite a lonely, just because I didn't really see my team in person. But we had frequent meets on Zoom, like we're doing now. Using Google Drive and these digital platforms just to send files, coordinate our production, and we still made it work. Even to this day, some of the team that was behind the production, I still haven't met them in person yet. But we've kept in touch. I've met a few people in person since we finished the production. But it took about a year. We started really working on the pre-production probably around summer of 2020. Finished end of March of 2021. It's beginning of 2021 was when it got really tough. We were really pushing against the clock as I was doing a lot of the labor of the color, the coloring, alongside my friend Hashim. And ironically, at one point, this film about mental health was actually weighing on my mental health, more because I was just passionate about getting it done. And yeah, just hoping that, okay, I really hope this film opens doors for me as a young black person trying to push this industry forward. But it feels like even just getting my foot in the door in this industry is hard, with job applications and things like that. So I was really counting on this film to open doors for me. And looking, fast forward, it really has opened doors and helped build my credibility within the animation industry. So it goes to show when you take the time to create something that is from the heart, true to who you are as an individual, and pushes against the grain in some way, it will pay off in the long run, even if it feels like the labor, is cumbersome. You just have to see the bigger picture of the impact that your work will have.
What are the major inspirations on Mental Roots?
So when I was doing my mood boards and kind of research, the way I work, to be honest, I'm not too heavily influenced by particular styles. I think I'm more influenced by particular topics or themes that get explored in other kinds of media. With that being said, I think I can't even remember off the top of my head what animation specifically inspired the style. I guess films like Hair Love, which I think came out in 2018 or 2019, that's an example of, I guess, relatively good black representation in animation. So I did a bit of research on animations like that, that kind of I felt helped push forward representation. But the main inspiration really for me was more internal and just kind of doing my research on the topic of mental well-being in the black community. And again, by that time, I already kind of had my own pastel-y style that I was working in Photoshop. So I just kind of adapted that from my uni coursework and just used that really. So I didn't refer too heavily to other particular art movements or styles to establish the look. It kind of just happened organically.
How important is poetry and spoken words as a part of the film?
Very important because, I mean, you see some of the metaphors used in the poetry reflected in the animation as well. And it's something I want to continue. In fact, even before I made Mental Roots, again, in my coursework at uni, I was already creating my own poetry and experimenting with making animation for that poetry as well. So I'm really interested in spoken word and animation and the unique combination that those two can have. You've got the poetic sort of metaphors of poetry, but then you've also got what I call visual poetry within animation, where you can visualize metaphors, like, I don't know, if pressure is building up in your head, for example, and you reflect that in some lines of poetry, you can literally show that in animation. So that's something I want to continue exploring more of moving forward in future projects. Because it's just something I haven't seen being done that much before, pairing poetry with animation. And I don't know anyone else who is also a poet as well as an animator like I am. And so with those two skill sets, I really want to maximize the unique power of that. And just experimenting with, sometimes the animation might come first and then I might make poetry to complement the animation. Or in the case of Mental Roots, it might be vice versa, just doing the poetry first and then doing the animation according to the poetry. But I think playing around with that relationship between the two art forms is a cool thing that I want to do more of.
What do you want audiences to take away from Mental Roots?
The takeaway I want from people who are watching Mental Roots is for them to feel inspired, number one, to consider a viewpoint that they haven't seen before, especially for those who are not men or who are not African or Caribbean. Hopefully, it will help give a bit more of a little insight into what it might be like to navigate the stigma of mental health from a young black male perspective. And in so many contexts, that could be so helpful. It can help for better sort of relationships within society, within workspaces, particularly within schools, where I've done a lot of my workshops playing the Mental Roots animation and encouraging students of all ethnic backgrounds to be more culturally aware of their peers and that we should all respect each other and be curious to learn more about each other's cultural backgrounds and how they influence the way we view the world. So yeah, just helping to promote multiculturalism, And yeah, there's power in vulnerability. There's power in opening up about your struggles and your transparency about your emotions and your well-being can unlock freedom for other people as well. So those are the takeaways I want viewers to get from the film.
Awesome. Is there anything in particular that you're looking forward to seeing or doing at Cardiff Animation Festival, just as an animation fan?
I've been to Cardiff Animation Festival once. I went 2 years ago, and I really liked the interactivity. There was like stop motion, sort of clay design workshop I remember going to, for example. So I look forward to I've booked like there's a wall doodle sort of workshop. So I look forward to more practical sessions like that, just creating and networking with people that way, doing some arts and crafts, and of course the screenings, right? My short film will be shown in the home screening, so I think that's the fifth kind of showcase that they're doing. So I look forward to that. I look forward to seeing other short films that are innovative and progressive in some way, and networking. I know a few people in the industry already who I met last time, and I look forward to so hopefully seeing them again and kind of building connections that way.
Yeah, awesome. That's all our questions. Thanks so much for talking with us today. It's been awesome.
Yep. Thanks, Chris.
Next up is Mariam Mahaja, whose film And Granny Would Dance is screening at this year's festival. Hi, Mariam Mahaja. Welcome to the AFA podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, to start basically at the very beginning, how did you get started in animation?
I think the first thing that was always with me since I can remember was the storytelling aspect of it. I was always a storyteller since I can remember. Then I got passionate about theatre and directing. I ended up doing my first BA in painting, and that was in Iran. And then I moved to the UK. I discovered animation. Doing another BA here. And I did a test of animation, a walk cycle, and it was like no other experience that I've had before. Like I didn't want to do anything else, basically. Yeah, I never looked back.
How did And Granny Would Dance come about?
The first point of inspiration for it was women, Iranian women, and how when they come together and feel safe in a space, they become such a force of healing, like a powerful, powerful source. It is based on my childhood memories, loosely. And it's also looking at our culture, the Iranian culture, as how like using humor, music, dance, and even singing, how we've used these through history to survive basically the hardships.
How did your background in painting influence the film's animation style?
Oh, very much, very much. I'm obsessed with that handmade feeling of things. Texture, I love texture, so I use layers and layers. And my work is always such a mix. Like there's always hand-drawn aspects to it, and then it's put together, then added digital elements to it as well. So I do, I do use that a lot in expressing and communicating my feelings and stories.
Why did you decide to tell this story through the eyes of a child?
A part of it is just like a natural process. Like the way I thought about the story, it was through the eyes of a child, basically myself, but also I do use I have used children as the main narrator because they are not prejudiced, they're not biased. They say it as it is. A lot of times they say things that they're not supposed to say, which I love. And a lot of times they hear things that they're not supposed to hear. So they're the best, one of the best sources to share secrets that no one even would know that they know. So yeah, I like that. Like the factual element of it, like the child is not taking sides. Is the child wouldn't try to manipulate the story in a way to get the audience to like lean towards some character or a specific narrative. And I love the humor that the child narrator brings with them, the unpredictable aspect of it.
Something you get to learn from the film's credits is the fact that you've referenced lots of original Iranian artworks. How did you go about this?
I use it's a big part of my work. I do use my heritage, and it's also to do with my painting background as well. So I look into like old Persian manuscripts, even Persian writing. If you look, I use writing as patterns, like as a visual element, that the Persian writing in my work. So yes, old Persian manuscripts. I look at them and I then pick and borrow like little elements, not as a whole. It could be like a tiny little flower in the corner of a huge painting, and then I like collage them into my work. But yeah, that was a very interesting process actually, because we had to find like these different museums that would. That had these beautiful archives.
It's really interesting. What were the major challenges you faced working on the film?
This was the first film that I got funding for, so this was the biggest project that I've done in form of animation. It's the longest film I've made as well. I know it's only 10 minutes, but it's long. So I was working with a bigger team. With a larger team compared to before, and also I was working with the BFI, so the whole process of like you would do a part of the work, then you would send it, and then you would get feedback. So there were a lot of meetings, whereas like most of my films, it's just me really most of the time just working, and then when it comes to sound and music, that's when I usually work with other people, but this was quite a team work from the beginning. It was great actually. It was really good to have that fresh eye on your work, because you could get quite close to your work and not really see it at the time, like what works and what may not work. So all those conversations, all those dialogues, and the back and forth, the feedbacks, it was very interesting. And it was, as I said, it was the first time I had to like work with a big team and direct people and communicate what I wanted to say from the start. Because with animation, it changes a lot. Like the first thing could be just a sketch as an idea, and like for people who are from the live action background, it's quite a different concept, because you don't see the final outcome. Like the thing you see at the early stages is so different from the final outcome. So that's, I think that was quite a challenge to communicate. Yes, it's a sketch now, but it's going to look like it's going to develop so much by the time it's finished. That was quite interesting. That was a new thing for me.
A couple of times in the film, the animation style changes. It's mainly when the character is telling a story, and it's a more cartoony style. What was the motivation behind doing that?
I wanted it to be different. I didn't with short films and animation, it's very easy to confuse the audience. So you need to be very clear at some points. And with this film, because I wanted it to say this is the child's imagination, there is the reality with all these lovely women talking. But at the same time, when they say it, the child goes into her own world of imagination, which is a strong part of the narrative as well, which is one of the main things, like the world that we create for ourselves as kids. So yes, I didn't want people to think, to get confused and say, okay, is this reality? Is the whole thing a fantasy? What's happening? And this is actually the first time probably that I got to work with another animator. Again, all my films, I'm the only animator on them. But with this one, I got a lovely animator to work on she was in charge of, like, I would give her the storyboard and she would just animate in her own style. As you can see, it looks nothing like my style, but that was what I wanted. I didn't want it to even look similar for like even a tiny chance of people thinking, oh, is it the same world?
What do you want audiences to take away from Granny Wood Dance?
Something that's quite key in my films is humanizing the dehumanized. Like I don't, and it's ridiculous how relevant it is again today. But I don't want people to think of like Iranian people as, you know, what you see on the news. Well, we've been called terrorists, we've been called propaganda, we've been called, I think, one of the best case scenario victims. I want people to see us as humans, as people who, you know, who love to share a cup of tea with their mates and make jokes, make cheeky, silly jokes. Which is something that I've realized happens with every, it's not just Iranian women, but when you get a group of women together in a place and help them feel safe, the cheekiness is amazing. The humor that comes out is, and that sense of freedom, no matter what culture or background it is, there is something really magical about it. So yes, and also, so yes, I want you to see us as people, as humans, like yourselves. Even like if it's a detail on like a tablecloth, like the way the girl picks the fruit, and say, oh, I remember that. Like I've done that. That's what I'm hoping for. And also, like if I were to say it like as in a short form, I would like it to feel like a like having a hug.
It's nice. Is there anything you're particularly looking forward to seeing or doing at the Cardiff Animation Festival?
I've been there once. I loved it. I would love to be able to attend it. I don't know if I can be there,
Yeah.
unfortunately. But I love how it's created a community. So it's not just about watching lots of amazing films. But when you've watched the films, there is also a space for you to have a dialogue with other filmmakers and people and audiences. I love that. I think one of the reasons we make films is to then talk to people about it, to show it to people and then to have a conversation. So yeah, I hope I can make it.
Do you have any advice for any up-and-coming filmmakers who might be wanting to submit their film to a festival?
Don't give up. Like there will be rejections. Aim for one festival as your like almost like a deadline, but if you don't get in, it's not the end of the world. It could take months until you get to your first festival. You get in the first festival. But when that happens, then it gets easier. But yeah, the main thing is don't give up. There will be rejections. Be prepared for rejections. But and when you get in a festival, if you can, definitely attend. It's amazing. It's such an amazing experience to watch your film with the audience, first of all. It's the best way of getting feedback. And then, as I said, you meet so many interesting people who have so much in common with you. So yeah, that's the two main things I would suggest.
Next up is Ellery Edwards, whose film Crybaby is screening at the Cardiff Animation Festival.
Ellery Edwards, welcome to the AFL podcast.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so to get started at the very beginning, how did you get started in animation?
Oh, right in. So well, I've always watched a lot of animation growing up, but also my auntie Jackie Edwards was quite she worked in animation for over 20 years, starting in short film work before going into television and production. So I studied animation in the University of South Wales. I graduated in 2019 with and I had made a short film called The Goat, and it went to a few film festivals in America, and also made it into Cardiff Animation Nights in the 2020 edition of Cardiff Animation Festival. And obviously, now I have my new short film called Crybaby.
So, how did Crybaby come to be?
So, as Cardiff Animation Festival does a program called Different Voices, so encourages neurodivergent animators and movie makers to collaborate with Bigger House Film Production, who are based in Bristol, to come up with an idea and then develop on it. And I think it was like two days before the deadline, I was struggling for ideas, and I was just like, should I just make have an idea loosely based on my experience getting diagnosed, which is what I did. And it was just two images. I had a few images, mainly myself, and it was a lot of, but the main theme was like scribbly, like my mind was just scribbles everywhere, and which ended up leading to the development of what I call like the voice of self-hate, or VOSH in short, to it. And I got partnered with Tom Stubbs, who was my mentor, then became producer of the film, and so we further developed it, showcased the idea at Cardiff Animation Festival in 2022. And after the talk, I met someone from Film Cymru who was looking for more underrepresented directors in to submit their ideas for the Beacon Short Film Programme in collaboration with BBC Wales.
How was the film's visual style developed?
So I kind of wanted to go back into my old style phases. So as I was in my teenage years, obviously anime was what I was constantly watching at the time, and obviously, as a lot of people had, when they were teenagers, when they watched anime, they were trying to, try and draw, mimic the style. So obviously, some looked good, some not so good. So I kind of wanted to go back to that stylization a little bit too. So just to try something different. And also we were also this was my first film using Moho, and as I was so myself and the other animators learning Moho, how to use Moho. So it's just a fun idea to try making a rig based on my stylization.
How closely did you decide to base it on your personal experiences?
The one important thing is that it was to do with my, well, basically how intense my emotions could get, hence Crybaby. I was called Crybaby growing up, because like any simple mistake I used to make as a kid, And when somebody pointed that out, for some reason, I just panicked. It was like a panicked emotion, anxiety, just rushing through the roof, and all I could do was just cry. So, and that was the one thing I wanted to bring into it. But obviously there are scenarios where I was like, okay, I don't want to fully base it on myself. So I kind of change the cat, obviously give the character a name, give the character just unique experiences, trying to trying to fit in, but obviously not quite, because people knew that she was different. And it's but the but obviously the core themes I wanted of, trying to accept myself. While obviously I wanted the main theme to be, self-acceptance, but also, raise awareness that, of how autism can affect people differently.
So how did Vosh, Voice of Self-Hate, how did that evolve as a character?
So my when we were when I was first developing the characters and deciding if I was going to animate it, whether it's the main issue we had of Osh, because I wanted him to be very scribbly, very noisy, thing, and my and obviously as I was planning to do it on a rigged animation soft, I was doing plan to do a rig doing it rigged rather than hand drawn. My first thought was, oh my God, how am I supposed to get Vosh working? Because he's very scribbly, he's very noisy. How is this possible on the rigged animation software? I probably would have to do a hand. He would be the only hand-drawn character, and he would just composite him in at the end. But we met Dani Abram, who I think everybody knows. She is the Wizard of Moho. I call it. That's my personal tagline of her, Wizard of Moho. We got into the contact with her, and she was like, "You can easily put noise on like line work of characters, so it makes it wobbly. Even if they don't move, the line, like the line and the shape of it will move about, even if they don't move." So we thought, okay, mate, okay, this could work. So and that was. I think that pretty much decided it for us. Once we did an animation test with her, we decided, yeah, I think we're going to do the whole thing on Moho.
So, why did you turn to Kickstarter for some of the funding of your film?
Well, it's mainly because we ran out of money.
No.
We ran out of money. We obviously wanted to give everybody, a fair wage, especially with jobs little and far and few between. So we looked into Kickstarter because the only thing left we had to do was music and any the music, the editing, any visual effects, which thankfully were only one or two scenes in the end. So we're just really grateful for everybody who pitched in towards it.
Awesome. And what particular challenges did you face making the film?
It is multitasking, I think. I think
Interesting.
as I ended up doing, well, thankfully I had amazing animators to work on almost all of the scenes and shots. Meanwhile, I was while giving feedback, approving shots, I was like doing backgrounds and this is and it's funny because when I was doing the goat, I realized I'm not good at backgrounds, so I handed some backgrounds to first and second years during uni, be like, right, can you make this look nicer? I've done some base work, can you just make it look nice, because I can't make it look nice. And here I am doing background, and here I am doing back, here I am doing backgrounds for Crybaby. So it was like story. So I did storyboards, some character design work, backgrounds and a proven shot. So the film ended up taking much longer to get made because I had to do other things alongside getting shots or making sure all the shots are done in the way I envisioned it from the storyboards. So
What do you have audiences take away from Crybaby?
understanding, I think, even if they may not be autistic themselves, it's understanding for people who have grown up undiagnosed like myself, whether it from be because nobody noticed or they could have had an opportunity, but they thought, no, I can't be autistic. It's no way. It's just to make them feel not alone. But I have met people who have seen the film who are not, autistic in the slightest. They felt some relatability to it, and I'm really glad that I could achieve that.
Awesome. Is there anything in particular you are looking forward to seeing or doing at Cardiff Animation Festival?
Just seen everyone, both from previous works and see what they're up to, what and it's just hoping, to see what the future is here for the animation industry here in Wales and further afield to see opportunities come out for everybody.
Awesome. Do you have any advice for up-and-coming filmmakers who might be wanting to submit their film to a festival?
Just submit it. Even if you don't think it is the best, even if you don't think it's the best thing in the world, as long as it's done, just submit it. You never know. That's what I did with The Goat. I didn't think it would get anywhere, and yet it managed to land into two festivals in America. You just never know. You just never know until you try. And keep making stuff. Keep drawing. Keep animating. Keep making things.
Awesome. That's all our questions.
Thank you very much, though.
Our next interviewee was Steph Lee, who directed the film Of All the Things, which is screening at the Cardiff Animation Festival this year. Hi, Steph Lee. Welcome to the AFA podcast.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris. I'm really glad to be here.
We always like to get started at the very beginning, which is with the question, how did you get started in animation?
So, it started in childhood, I guess. I just love cartoons. I love watching animation. I was like a big Disney kid. What actually made me think about it seriously as a job is I saw a making of special of A Bug's Life. So this is like showing my age a bit. But yeah, it was showing like how they were creating all these 3D models and like creating this animated world. And like at the time I was really into like drawing, but I was also really into like playing games on my computer. And I was like, well, that looks cool. That's both of those things. Maybe I could do that as a job. So yeah, that kind of started my interest. And then at school, I just went through the usual. I was doing art and design, but digital art was like really in its infancy there. Like I couldn't really do that at school. And then I went to Art Foundation at college, and I did actually get to make my first animations there, but it was all stop motion, so like paper cut stop motion. Then I moved on to Norwich Art School, which is now newer, I think Norwich University of Arts, and I did graphic design with animation there. So yeah, I finally got to make films then from my first year of uni. And then basically after graduation, I just went straight into freelancing because it was 2008, there weren't many jobs. So I was doing a lot of local arts projects. I worked with local theatres and a lot of animation workshops, just kind of building my portfolio. I made another short film, and that was through a local arts project. And yeah, that's it really. And I eventually then moved on. I did a bit of animation for children's games, which is where I got into educational animation, I guess. And then I did that for about 3 years before deciding to go freelance again. I just preferred the lifestyle, I guess. And yeah, and then eventually I set up my own business, Kino Bino, and that's what I'm doing now. So yeah, that's the journey, I guess.
So, what's the story behind your newest film with all the things?
Yeah, so it's a short animation and it's about a mother-daughter relationship and how that's kind of tested by hoarding disorder. So the aim of the film is to foster understanding and combat stigma around hoarding. So it follows Ava, our main character, I guess. There's two characters, as a child, and then basically she leaves the home and comes back and realizes something's not quite right, and it's how she deals with that really and how it affects the relationship with her mother.
What was it that made you want to make a film highlighting hoarding disorder?
Yeah, so for me, this was quite a personal project. I had a personal motivation behind it. So it was based, well, it is, the film is based on like my personal lived experience. And at the time, I guess the original idea for this film is I was a lot closer to the commercial work I was doing. I wanted to do like an explainer video or an educational film that was purely motivated on hoarding awareness. Like I wanted to reduce the shame around it. I wanted to get facts out there. I wanted to make it easy to talk about. But that project basically couldn't get off the ground. And then I ended up kind of channeling all that energy into a more narrative piece, basically. And we were re really lucky because my producer found the BFI network funding, which is basically how the current version of the film came to be. So yeah, I think like what I was really keen to do with this film was show hoarding in a different way to how it's been traditionally shown on the media. So, you know, like house clearance TV shows, reality TV shows. I wanted to do something different, and I wanted to do something that was a bit magical, I guess, which is what you can achieve with animation, isn't it? You can create stuff that's a bit fantastical. And yeah, I guess I'm hoping that yeah, by creating this film, it will kind of help people feel more seen, like people who are in similar situations. And yeah, I think narrative films are much more powerful at doing that than perhaps what my original idea was. So yeah, that's the sum up of it.
The film's got a really lovely sort of picturey book sort of style to it. How did you develop the visual style?
Oh, thank you. So yeah, the visual style, I mean, so I created a lot of mood boards. I've got a lot of reference that I really loved and pulled together. Like I really wanted it to be quite colourful and quite textured. Especially with like the hoarded home, I didn't want to create anything too realistic. Not only because it would be really difficult to illustrate like everything, but I also didn't want it to be too visually cluttered or triggering to people who've lived with hoarding behaviours. So that was one thing I was thinking about. Like in terms of the items in the house, I wanted to show the things as like kind of one big entity. And the characters are kind of the main focus. It's not about the items, if that makes sense. And yeah, I guess we were really lucky because we had a couple of graduates working in the studio at the time, and Mary worked on the colour script for us. She created this beautiful colour script, and it kind of reflects the emotion of the film. So like the hoard almost becomes like its own character, I guess. Like it's quite intense pinks and purples when those emotions are quite high, to like more neutral when things calm down, like neutral blues. So yeah, it was really great, and we were really lucky to have her on the project. Just I felt like she really pulled all that together.
It's really, really beautiful looking film.
Thank you.
There is also some like fantasy sequences in the film. What was the motivation behind them?
Well, like I said, I wanted to get a bit of magic into the film. I think like the opening sequence is kind of in an imaginary world, and I just really wanted to get across that for young children growing up in hoarded homes, that it's not seen as a problem. Do you know what I mean? They don't know any different when they're really small, and it's kind of like a playground, and you could have adventures, and there's a lot of things and places to hide. So I kind of wanted to capture that element of it. And yeah, later on, like there's like a memory sequence, which was it was heavily inspired by Glen Keane's Duet, like with I wanted like these ghostly figures. And like have these kind of beautiful ribbons like coming out of the items. And we worked with a local animator, Imogen, in Leicester. She worked on that sequence with us, and yeah, I think what she did was really great. I was really happy with it.
Awesome. Why did you decide to make the film dialogue free?
Well, personally, I love non-dialogue films. I just think they're really powerful. Like, so much can be said with the visuals and also the soundtrack. Like, the soundtrack's like 50% of the film anyway. So I was keen on that. It was also, there were also like financial reasons. Like, it's cheaper to make non-dialogue film. But the benefit of it is that it's now like super accessible. So it can go internationally. Like, we don't need to subtitle it, and anyone can access it basically, and children can access it as well. So yeah, that's just something that's really special about dialogue films. Because what I really hope is that this can go international and be used like for holding awareness globally. So yeah, fingers crossed.
Ah, smart. You don't have to pay the actors.
Yeah, well, it's just like the budgets are so tight, and I can tell you a bit more about that in a bit, but like it's just, yeah, just trying to get the project off the ground with the and make sure everyone's paid. It's just really, really difficult, really, really difficult.
You know, which, what were the particular challenges making the film?
Well, the first challenge was that our funding got confirmed right before my daughter was born, like 2 months before, and I was about to go on maternity leave. So that was a massive challenge. But I decided, because this film, we'd already been working on it for over a year, like internally doing the script and like sketching ideas and mood boards, we'd already been doing that. So this film kind of felt like my first baby, if that makes sense. So when my daughter was 2 months old, I was like, let's just start, it'll be fine. But in hindsight, was not a good idea. I think like during the postpartum period, like a lot of mistakes were made that would then later cost us later on, if that makes sense. But you know, it was still great because we had two graduates working in the studio at the time, and they were brilliant. I mentioned Mary already, he did the colour script. We had Catherine, who was working on basically all the story development, characters. She was helping with everything, rigging, little bits of animation. So yeah, and then, like I mentioned before, we'd applied for the BFI Network short film fund, and we'd got a pot of money from then, but we were also as a studio self-funding as well, so that was coming out of a proportion of our commercial work. However, yeah, the cost of living crisis hit, and the US writers' strike hit right at the same time, which actually really impacted our business, even though we're small and we're not even working in like traditional TV and film, but like the larger companies were then taking up the work that we were doing, if that makes sense. So we had to like completely stop. We had to like let some of our staff go, and it was very stressful. We just had to stop production and kind of recalibrate and be like, what are we going to do here? Are we going to finish it, or are we just going to leave it? At that point, we'd already done all the pre-production, so it was I just didn't want to stop, basically. I was like, there's no way we've come this far. So we decided to start building a community around the film. That's with the hoarding community in the UK. So they're like charities and local organisations, fire services, and we ran a crowdfund campaign, and we also looked for corporate sponsorship to kind of get the money up so we could get the film finished and over the line. And it was really challenging and very, very, very stressful. And you know, it took the production over like 4 5 years instead of the original plan for it. But I think it was a blessing in a way, because actually it allowed the film to become much more embedded in the communities that we want to make an impact in, if that makes sense. So yeah, it's like it was so hard, but there are positives to it as well.
How much did you bring your personal experiences to the film?
Well, I mentioned before, like, why I made the film about hoarding disorder. Like, it was deeply personal, and the whole motivation was about telling a story about hoarding that hadn't been seen on screen before. Like I said, like, changing the way it's portrayed. And I think when making the film as well, it was kind of, that was also challenging for me, I guess, personally, but it was also almost therapeutic. I think, like, when you channel these things into art or filmmaking, then yeah, it's kind of helpful for you as well to like, yeah, go through your personal experience, I guess.
What do you want audiences to take away from of all the things?
I guess it's just like looking at those people who live in hoarded homes in a different way, like, rather than focusing on the stuff in the home and as a problem to fix, like, we need to get all this stuff out, but actually notice that these are real people living their lives, and they are really struggling, and it's quite complex. And yeah, I guess what I'm really hoping for is that, you know, if there are people who are in these similar situations, that the film kind of might spark something in them to speak up about something or start looking for support. Yeah, that's kind of what I really, really, really want from it. That's my biggest hope.
Is there anything in particular that you're looking forward to seeing or doing at Cardiff Animation Festival this year?
Yeah, there is actually Julia Potts there, and I've been following her career for like a really long time, so I'm quite excited to see her speak in person, and I think that'll be really great. There's a feature that I wanted to see, Little Amelie, or the character of
Oh,
Rain.
yeah.
Have you seen it? I've not
I
seen it.
haven't, no, I haven't seen it
Yeah,
yet, but I really want to.
it looks beautiful. Like, I've been following it online for ages, and I was like, yes, so I'm gonna go and see that. And yeah, I'm just really excited. Like, I love going to animation festivals. I love Cardiff Animation Festival. I went for the first time in 2024, and it was just such a good vibe. And like, everyone's really friendly, and you just get to see industry people. And yeah, just getting to watch like loads of shorts, it's just so inspiring. Like, yeah, just watching all the selections. So yeah, that's it. I'm just excited about it all.
Well, thank you. That's all our questions.
Okay. Yeah, so is that it? Is there anything else? Or
There is one other question, which is that have you got any advice for up and coming filmmakers that might be wanting to submit a film to a festival?
yes, I do actually, because this is our first festival film, like, where we've actually been like, we're going to do a festival run. Like, we've entered our commercial films into the Odd Festival, but without kind of any real strategy. And I think what I really didn't realise about film festivals is that you kind of have to sort that strategy out early on so that you can make the most of your budget. So, like, with the BFI network funding, we had a pot allocated for budget, and we also had a chat with the wonderful Festival Formula. I don't know if you've heard of them. But they kind of help with film strategy. And yeah, it's kind of looking for the festivals that match your film. So, match the themes of your film. What kind of films have they screened before that might be similar? Because we're a majority female team as well, like, we've been looking at women's film festivals. So, it's kind of like finding places where your film will kind of slot in. Yeah, I think that's like the biggest thing I've learned, because I just wasn't aware of that at all before.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks, Chris. Thanks so much for inviting me on. I hope it was hope it was helpful for you to hear about the behind the scenes.
Lastly, we have Laura Jane Hodkin, whose film Wuthering Heights is screening at this year's festival. Laura Jane Hodkin, welcome to the AFA podcast.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Awesome to have you. We always like to start with basically breaking in stories. So, how did you get started in animation?
Well, I was obviously drawing a lot as a teenager, and I feel like everyone says that. I did a lot of illustration stuff when I was in college, This is before I'd like really decided what I wanted to do at uni. I guess I felt like I wanted to try something really new, because I was thinking, oh, I'm going to go and do illustration, but actually, I just felt like I wanted to be challenged a bit more. Not that I think illustration is easy at all or like simple, just maybe I felt like animation was more technical, so I could really get my teeth into something totally new that I hadn't done before. So I decided to go to the Edinburgh College of Art to study animation. That was in 2014. It was actually also because of an artist I really liked. Her name is Magda Boreasha. She was a comic artist and she was also an animation filmmaker, and she went to Edinburgh also and did that same course. That was a few years ahead of me. And I remember finding her comics in like a weird shop in Sheffield, and when I found out she did animation, I think that really solidified what I wanted to do, because I was really enjoying like comics at the time, but also seeing her work moving was very satisfying. So yeah, I studied animation at Edinburgh, and then after those 3 years, I still felt a bit, I was doing this a lot of sort of experimental, I would say, animation. It wasn't quite like how narrative my work is now. So I think I felt a bit worried about getting into the animation industry. So that's what really pushed me to want to go and study at the Royal College of Art after that, to do an MA in animation, which, yeah, I then graduated in 2019. And after making my films there, I definitely felt more secure in myself and my work. And then straight after graduating, really, I was approached by Strange Beast, which is a London-based animation studio, and they asked to represent me. So I've been represented by them since 2020, but that's mainly for commercial work. Yeah, and on the side, I've been doing short films and weird drawings. Yeah.
And how, what's the story behind your new film, Wuthering Heights?
Well, that started as 4 episodes, very short episodes I made for a TikTok channel called Studio Digital. They also have a presence on Instagram, but it's mainly for their TikTok. And they are a sort of side studio to Bento Box Entertainment. And basically, what they do is they commission indie artists to make shorts. So that's where they came from. And I just at the time I moved back from London to up north, and now I live in Yorkshire. And I was pretty obsessed with the moors and also thinking about my teenage years growing up incredibly emo, and just I had this image in my mind of like teenagers, emo teenagers walking across the moors listening to very sad music, and that's where the inspiration came from for that. And then I basically just put them together into a short film because I think it's very satisfying to me to see them all together like that as one short.
How far was the film actually influenced, if at all, by Wuthering Heights, the original novel or earlier adaptations?
It wasn't really at all. I really enjoyed Andrea Arnold's version of Wuthering Heights from 2011, I think it was. And actually, I had recently watched that just before, and I think that maybe sparked the Moors feeling, because that film has such like a beautiful way to show the nature, but also like these young kids growing up in these in the wild ruralness. But apart from that, not really so. I just really liked the idea of playing on the name a bit. I guess it kind of, my version kind of plays on the class thing, but definitely not as much as the real story. Yeah, I would say not much at all, really.
How was the film's visual style developed?
I guess that goes back to just how my style looks in general. I'm not really sure, to be honest. I really wanted it to have a very textured sort of painterly backgrounds to express the sort of rustic vibe of the moors and that setting. But I'm also not a background artist, so they're not, it's not the best look, I would say, but I'm really happy with how it turned out. Just yeah, I wanted to nail that for the backgrounds and then have my sort of signature character style on top. So it felt very, I don't know, a kind of mixture of like cozy almost and then quite scrappy because my work is very, it's not very clean at all, really, to me. Yeah. Also, I didn't have much time to make these, so I didn't get that much time to sort of work on the style for this at all.
What were the major challenges you faced working on the film?
Probably time. Yeah, I made them in like, because they originally were just these four episodes, I had like, I forgot how many months. It was like maybe 4 or 5 months. It was very like rush, 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 go, go, go. But I also kind of like that. I don't really like spending too long on something because then I get a bit bored of the idea, maybe, or I get a bit. I start to think, oh, what am I making? What if people don't like it? So this was quite nice, just do it and get it out there. And yeah, I'm glad people liked it.
What are major influences on Wuthering Heights?
Well, the Moors for sure. And yeah, it probably would be Andrea Arnold's Wuthering Heights. Probably Patrick McHale, the animation artist, and his series Over the Garden Wall is a slight inspiration, but I really like that anyway. So that's kind of a sort of back inspiration for all of my work. And a lot of emo music, My Chemical Romance. I think they have such a beautiful sense of self, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. Me being an emo teenager, that was a big inspiration. Yeah. And my friends, actually, yeah, growing up with them. Yeah. Also, Yorkshire. Actually, a lot of inspirations. Yeah.
Awesome. Film setting is kind of hard to put a finger on because mostly it seems like a period piece, but the emo goth angle is quite modern. How did you approach the setting? You didn't
Yeah, originally I had it set in just the modern day, and it was like these two emo kids standing under a tree on a hill. That was actually the first image which I drew. And then I think I had maybe the night before, that's when I'd watched Wuthering Heights. And I remember looking at this image and thinking, oh, the one that I'd drawn, and thinking, this is kind of boring. Oh, there's not. What am I trying to say with like this image of these two emo teens? Because that's what the shorts were going to be about anyway, like emo teenagers. And then I just thought, how funny would it be if they were set, if it was in the 18th century, emo teenagers, and how would they act in the 18th century? So it was really fun to sort of figure out like how she would get ready in the morning, like turning the rat's tail and throwing it into her hair to like, that's like the rat comb vibe, or using the matchstick for the eyeliner and stuff like that. Like that added another level of humor to me to have it set in that era.
What do you want audiences to take away from Wuthering Heights?
Maybe that it's okay to be a bit cringy and also to laugh and have a good time. Yeah, it's not really that deep. I just really enjoy making funny stuff in general, and yeah, that's it really.
Yeah, he's very funny, so.
Oh, thanks.
Is there anything you're particularly looking forward to seeing or doing at Cardiff Animation Festival this year?
Oh well, unfortunately I won't be able to make it this year,
No.
but I was really looking forward to seeing Julia Pott because she is one of my big inspirations. So yeah, that's kind of sad. And I'm sure well, and I actually really would have loved to have seen Wuthering Heights on the big screen as well. That's always fun because I love hearing people's reactions. Yeah.
Do you have any advice for up-and-coming filmmakers that might want to submit a film to a festival?
Oh, that's a good question. I would probably say don't, just because I wish someone had said this to me, don't be too disheartened if your film doesn't get in. This is about festivals in general, right? Yeah, don't be too disheartened if your film doesn't get into a festival, even if it's a small festival, a big festival, because at the end of the day, there is people picking these films to fit for that, it's the right moment. So it doesn't mean your film wasn't good enough, or it doesn't put like your self-worth down. Like it's just more about maybe it didn't fit the program, or maybe the lineup of people picking the films wasn't interested in it, but that's also a small amount of people sometimes. So I don't know. Yeah, I wouldn't be too upset about that or get too down on it, and don't let that stop you from submitting to film festivals. Because at the beginning, when I first submitted my films, like when I graduated, and I did not get into any festivals at all, and I remember feeling really sad about it. But I think getting older, I sort of realized it doesn't really place a value on your film. Yeah.
Now, all these years later, you're getting into prestigious festivals like Cardiff. So keep going.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you so much for answering our questions. That's all our questions for today.
Oh, great. Oh, that's good.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to catch up with everything we're doing, visit us at animationforadults.com for the latest animation news, reviews, and stuff. On social media, you can find us on Twitter at AFA Blog. You can find us on Facebook, Pinterest, Tumblr, Instagram, and more coming soon. If you'd like to help us out, you can visit us at patreon.com/animationforadults or make a donation via PayPal or buy us a virtual coffee. Thanks again for listening and stay tuned for more.